a lot of people will privately, including major pop stars, will privately talk to me and say, I agree with you. I actually read that book.
There was, I think in 2022, Marcus Mumford said they begged you to stay. Did you feel like you had that support?
No one begged me to stay. What you got to remember about the New York Times is that in the 1930s, they shilled for Hitler. Yeah. In the 1950s, they shilled for Stalin. And in the late 50s, they shilled for Fidel Castro. So I tell you what, if the New York Times don't approve, that's a good thing. You don't want to be approved by the New York Times. You're not in good company. I actually just had a... I debated Nancy Pelosi last week.
What's she like? What's Nancy Pelosi like?
Well... Don't get me wrong, I use the word like radical. I use it to mean people who practice political extremism or violence, political violence. So I would use the word radical then.
Yes.
So I would say radical right in that said, or radical progressives. I actually prefer to say radical progressives and Antifa, because that's almost like a word that gets people's backs up and it's not helpful.
Right.
So I'm not against using the word radical.
Yeah.
And there's also terms where I'd be like, well, when I was a kid, radical was radical.
You're rad. Yeah.
Like that word.
Right.
But so I'm just curious about the meaning of
it's
that.
It's like
so.
Charlie Sheen in his classic interview. He's like, oh, radical people. Like when he used it there, he wasn't talking about wing nuts. He was talking about Sean Penn and Liam Neeson, people who were cool, you know, that reached out there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, wow, we are graced with the presence of Winston Marshall today. This is incredible.
Did you bring your banjo by chance?
I thought that you would.
Yeah, we are bringing it for you.
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm thrilled for your success. And it's
thank you.
I like to meet people looking for the sensible middle and not afraid to speak to people from all sides, because I think that's how we get through all of this. Call me old fashioned.
We could not agree more. I think if polarization's an existential issue and what it looks like. It's funny too, because most people, as we've learned traveling the country, they feel generally the way we feel, where they're tired of having to walk on eggshells or be so tribal or lose friendships or family relationships over politics. People are exhausted with it. Yeah. It's not natural. It's not healthy. It's killing communities. It's hurting families. We're tired of it.
Yeah.
It's ruined careers.
Yeah.
It's
a great tragedy of the time, you know, and this doesn't get covered in media, because media normally covers stories.
Right.
So, or like news stories. But one of the things I've heard about the last 8 years, particularly since 2016, is the amount of friend groups and families and marriages that have broken down utterly needlessly over difference on politics, or because it's got to such a point where the division is so vast now that people can't keep normal relationships. That to me is the tragedy of the era, amongst other tragedies. But
the unfortunate one.
Yeah, do you see that in the UK the same way in the US?
For sure. In the UK, it happened around Brexit. Brexit tore up. I think I know three relationships that broke up because of Brexit. And since then, probably not, although COVID kind of split people up again, if people fell on different... It was weird. Since 2016, we basically had... And it got turbocharged since 2020. Every year, there's a new topic that just cuts through the middle of everything. 2020, the pandemic. 2021, the Russia-Ukraine war. 2022, what was 22? There was something in 22. Now it's Gaza, Israel. You know, every year there's something that just...
I think Russia-Ukraine had a sequel. That ran back-to-back years, yeah.
That's quite possible. I mean, the Gaza stuff that we're seeing, I come to New York and see what's going on on the university campuses, Gaza Plaza up the road. That is, to me, it looks like the same people as the BLM stuff from 2020. Mm-hmm. I don't know what do you think? Have I got that right or wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more about a social group, frankly, than any beliefs.
Yeah.
Like you look at a lot of people and a lot of the conversations you have, and both my roommates here in New York are at Columbia Law. So they're there every day and they're in the group chats. And it's the same kind of ideas and the same kind of like approach to things that we saw in 2020 across the country.
I think it's kind of like you have the same core activist class. And we know this because we, in our early Roka days, we launched Summer 2020. And our first road trip, when we were just sort of going past the polling, we wanted to talk to normal people across the country. What do you view the news? And so we, in our conversations, and you know, we'd always hear, oh, the same sides kind of tyrannically control the narratives and they only push their own agenda. But part of that too is we wanted to go to the more extreme rallies, whether a Trump rally or BLM rallies. And the people you see at the Gazan campus, I just passed the NYU one, which is, you know, 80,000 a year college. You could just see it's an activist class, and you interview them, and sure, Fox News will cherry pick the dumbest takes to totally discredit it. There are some educated people there, but we've interviewed them, and there are also a lot of super uneducated people that just seem to be there because oppressor, press framework, we've figured out who's on which team, and so we're going to go all in and now take over Hamilton Hall. I mean, what's your take?
Yeah. It's a similar thing in London. There are some very smart people who take both sides.
Yeah.
But for sure, I mean, friends of mine, Trigonometry, did an interview, did a report, as did Unheard, by the way. They did, both of them did coverage where they interview people on the marches in London. I think there's been 13 marches now since October.
Constantine.
And they couldn't name the river from the river to the sea. They couldn't name the river. They couldn't name the sea. They couldn't tell you what year Israel had been formed. They say, oh, for 100 years. Well, actually, Israel didn't exist 100 years ago. What are you talking about? Yeah. If you actually pick them up on it, it's a dead conversation.
Right.
So there's a curious thing there. I think there's something to do with social media's massively turbocharged. I see it with this new era. I mean, this is something Jonathan Haidt's going into a little bit in his book, which I'm in the middle of reading. But the impact of 2009, 10, 11, 12, Facebook, Instagram, introducing the like button, the retweeting, all of that stuff. That's kind of when the beginning of this nonsense or this new era, I think, began. I think there's a few other things tied in there. I think that the bailout in 2008 is a big part of that, and the larger populist worldwide movement that's going on. But in this, a lot of this, what we're seeing is a social media.
Right. The anxious generation, that is. The new book, talking about how...
Exactly.
Young people,
And I think there's also a general lack of meaning for so many people. And when something like this comes around, it's like, oh, great. Perfect timing.
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, beyond just anecdotes and the interviews we've done, the organizer of the Columbia protest is a young man by the name Kamani James. And he was an activist in high school. He actually went to Boston Latin School, which is the biggest feeder of Harvard. It's an exam school. He got there, very rough childhood, but he resigned from the student councils he was on in high school over the George Floyd protests. He was super active in that. He sort of developed this mentality of abrasive activism where you make people feel uncomfortable, confrontational activism. Mm. So he's just a good example of, now he's wearing the keffiyeh. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Keffiyeh. And now he's wearing that. But 4 years ago, middle of those charts. So there's definitely a core. Are there, obviously passions based on heritage and people who are more educated, who are from the Middle East, who know what they're talking about? Absolutely. But that core.
It's something that, so Mary Harrington, who is actually going to be speaking at Dissident Dialogues this weekend, she's a great author and sort of reactionary feminist is what she calls herself. She calls this the omni-cause, in which it's one giant thing that seems to be the giant lump of causes that everyone seems to be following.
And I see a kind of the current things. I've heard that framework.
Yeah.
So Dissident Dialogues.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm here to promote.
Yes.
Thank you. I hope this gets published in time.
You know you're a nerd. You know you're a nerd when this feels like a music festival, like where you see the lineup and you're like, oh, no way. It just feels like, oh, and then even the next tier, which is like the smaller EDM artists, kind of like, oh, wow, they've got Alex O'Connor.
Well, that's the vibe we wanted to do, right? Yeah. So it was... I come from a music industry background, obviously.
We've heard.
And we used to put on festivals all over America, over the world, and take over tiny towns. And I kind of wanted to take that approach to this world. So coming to this world, I noticed there's everyone's kind of engaging online. And I would meet all these people, partly because they would reach out to me. And I'm very social, so I would meet them. And I noticed that everyone's sort of alone. And there was a desire for community. I was like, okay, well, that was one thing. I was like, maybe we can, how can we bring people together? And the other thing I noticed was that there are some ideas, festivals type things. I've spoken to a couple. I spoke at Freedom Fest as a libertarian festival. I'm not a libertarian, but I spoke there last summer. And there's a couple others across the world. But some of them, and this very famous case that happened with Coleman Hughes at TED, where, and he wrote about this in the Free Press, but he wrote, he gave a lecture, a keynote about called colorblind, and defending the case for a colorblind society. And there was a contingency within TED that tried to have the speech censored from their, not published rather, censored is probably not the appropriate word, not published from their, on their YouTube. And so it occurred to me, oh wow, so that there's actually a bent of censorship within these things, and there's a political leaning of within these festivals. So I think we should have a festival where you can actually, all strokes of ideas, diversity of opinion is celebrated, and try and bring people like around, you know, bring back that community sense. So it's, and hopefully, if I'm right, if there is a, you know, if the market wants diversity of, the, of opinion, if it, then people will like this, and they are, you know, they've bought the tickets, so it should be, it should be a kind of, yeah. Another thing I wanted to do was not be, I kind of didn't want it to be sort of tweed jackets. I wanted, right, I was like, let's do Ideas Festival, but like leather jackets.
That's the kind of
the atmosphere we wanted to create. So, you know, it's going to be beers on the water and
in Brooklyn.
And food trucks. And so hopefully kind of got a relaxed vibe to it. We'll see. It's kind of a risk, but it should be fun.
Were you always involved, or not even involved, but like, have you always been interested in this kind of stuff, or was it after what happened in 2021 that you started to get engaged?
I've always been interested in this stuff. My, you know, my family is, I've got journalists and writers and authors. And so it's like the dinner table. I couldn't tell that whether I was weird or different. You guys are obviously readers and thinkers, right. but not necessarily everyone is, you know, it's like only 1% of people really read articles every day. It's not really what people do, but I actually had this feeling at home, and cause I come to New York and have a place downtown, and I used to live here, and I remember reading all these people that are on the festival and just thinking, oh, and like, you know, reading people like Pinker or Dawkins or Ian, and now I'm like, wow, I was, you know, they were these intellectuals and brilliant minds, and someone like Ian or Mazia Linajad were total heroes, dissidents, incredibly brave dissident legends who had escaped persecution, were exiles, and now they're all coming together. So for me, it's like, wow, like the world that I was, by some weird, curious sequence of events that I could never have predicted and should definitely wouldn't have chosen.
I've
been thrown. I guess this is what's happening. Anyway, that's not very well articulated version.
I think that's, I mean, first of all, I think there almost needs to be a cultural fitness craze phenomenon that needs to take place around dissident dialogue type events, because it is healthy to get exposure to alternative viewpoints. And right now the social media landscape makes you so cozy, so comfortable in your echo chamber, where first of all, they structurally prevent you from getting exposure to other ideas because the feed does not reward content you don't engage with. So obviously you're not, so you feel so cozy, so comfortable in this area, but that's not healthy. And it's not healthy for the country. It's not healthy for critical thinking. It's not healthy for anybody involved except for the social media platforms and also for media publishers who benefit from having this audience that they feed stuff they already believe over and over and over. And it's insane. And one thing that I find so sinister about all this is the labeling that takes place. And I think people who don't pay close attention fall prey to it. So for example, some of the people in dissident dialogues, you bring up Coleman Hughes.
John McWhorter is similar, he's on it, and he's
a similar thing. People will label them, they labeled you as something you're not. And it's so tyrannical because most people are casual consumers, as you say. So they'll hear about Winston and they'll be like, oh wait, he's far right? Or Constantine Kizin, he's far right? Coleman Hughes, he's right wing? Joe Rogan, he's right wing?
Yeah.
And they're not.
Yeah.
It just, I mean, how do you feel when you see yourself labeled and you're like, I'm not this way? Like this, you can't just—
You know, it's a good question. And it's actually, it's part of the mess we're in, because the first time when you get called these things, like you get called fascist or far right, which by the way is— Right. So unbelievably ludicrous. My family literally escaped the Nazis because they were Jews, most of them were killed. So the idea of being called Nazi and fascist is just like, what? Like, are you joking?
Fascism has
it, But there's a bunch of words, let's say far right, racist, or anti-Semite, or fascist, that you just don't want to be called. You don't want that word attached to you. And so actually that's what why there's a censorship that's been going on. It's because it's actually a very effective way of people
it's
to
so
shut
effective.
Up. It's like, don't you know, look at J.K. Rowling. She gets called all these nonsense things. Like she gets called a fascist or a transphobe when she's not any of those things.
It's insane.
And it keeps people, I know loads of people in the music industry who would agree, but just like don't dare not touch the topic because once you're tarred with a brush, you can't be untarred. You can't be cleaned of it.
What happened when you clicked tweet on that message in 2021 that led all this to come down? I mean, like you click the button, then did you immediately start seeing responses, or was it a day later you woke up, you checked your DMs, and you're like, wow, I'm in deep shit?
It wasn't like a bomb. It kind of grew, and I thought, oh no, just leave it. It'll die. Like it can't. But then just kept going, and it was over the course of a weekend. And I just thought, oh, it would die. But then it just kept growing and going up all the trending lists, in certainly in my country, and I think in this country. And by the end of the weekend, just for your listeners who don't know, I was tweeting about books through the pandemic that I'd been reading to my not very many followers. On Twitter, I had 3,000 followers, so not really anyone. This tweet, I tweeted about a book called Unmasked by Andy Ngo, so an American conservative journalist, Vietnamese American, and it documents the BLM riots of 2020, the 19 people killed in the first 14 days. It documents all the Antifa behavior, including the whole month of June 2020, when the Portland federal courthouse was under siege, under insurrection, technically insurrection. And I don't know how, but it blew up. I was naive into how Twitter worked. And, you know, you don't get to choose what hill you die on. And I was quite frustrated. It's annoying when you die on what might be a molehill. So from the point of view of the music industry, like BLM, everyone supported. Like, if you remember Black Square Tuesday, like, you had to put out a black square. That was, they erected a picket line that if you didn't post a black square, you were against it. And look up what happened to the band Hanson. They posted a black square like a day late or something. I can't remember exact details. And they got, you know, in all sorts of trouble for it. The hysteria at that time.
Wait, did Mumford & Sons post anything? Do you remember?
I think we did.
Right.
And I wouldn't have... I was pretty affected by the George Floyd thing, to be honest, and pretty emotional about it. I would say I had a slightly more nuanced take that I didn't support Black Lives Matter, the organization.
Right.
I'd read all the literature, Patrice Khan Colors. Before that, I was living in New York. Everyone was talking about BLM and these kind of things. So I was brushed up. I knew that they were a Marxist organization. I knew that it was anti-family. If I didn't know, I was soon to know that they were anti-Israel. And, you know, I knew that they were extreme.
Yeah.
And then look what they did with the money.
Yeah.
But you couldn't, I didn't appreciate that this topic, it was a slightly different story in England. I didn't quite appreciate how divisive the issues here in America. And by the end of 2 days, it was a segment on Tucker and The View. And I was like, what the hell? But more significantly, it was like in my personal life and in my business life, all the phone calls start happening. And it's like, that was a horrible time that I don't particularly like to to relive. But I will say, I through it all, having stuck with my guns and having gone down a path that I didn't anticipate or could never have imagined, I'm very glad to have kept my soul and my dignity through it all, you know, I say that so that if anyone's in such a position where they're self-censoring or nodding along with things they shouldn't do, has someone now, if that's 3 years ago, having gone through it all, I'm so glad I kept my dignity, or at least I I feel like I kept my dignity.
Did you at least, despite that incredible turmoil, was there an outpouring of support? Did you feel at least some level of embrace then?
I was very surprised by that. I think that letter got read over a million times. It got read. Yeah. That Medium piece, I think, was like 600,000 or 650, but then it got reshared on other media outlets, mm-hmm. like the Daily Mail, I think the New York Post or something. They put it out. My feeling at the time, the period before that, so again, this is not the whole story has been said here, but initially after the tweet, I apologized to try and kill it because it was like kicking a hornet's nest. They came, all these activists came after, not just me, they came after my whole band and their families, and things like threatening to, you know, to hurt us, hurt them. Things like going on. Someone went onto my Wikipedia page that night and changed it from Winston Marshall is a banjo player to Winston Marshall is a fascist. And I had a friend like helping me out, changing it back. But she was up all night because they kept changing it back. And I think it changed like six times. They do everything they can to destroy your reputation. And so I wanted to kill all of that. And I was like, maybe I don't know everything about this topic. Like, I just read one book. Like, maybe I knew quite a lot about the topic. But I was still open to, you know, thine ignorance of thine ignorance is thy fairest foe. I accepted happily that I might not know the whole story. So then I looked into it. I issued this apology. I spent a few months really getting into it, like looking into the topic. What were my blind spots? What have I made wrong? And eventually, I mean, again, I've said this story so many times, so your listeners can find it elsewhere, but eventually decided to publish the letter as you described and basically retracted my apology. But the only way I could do that, for various reasons, I had to quit the band as well. So as you say, it kind of had a viral moment. Now, but at that point, by the time I published the letter, I just needed to clear my conscience. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I was like, I've been part of the lie. Like this letter, apologizing when I'd done nothing wrong. I was like, what if I had kids? Like I'd be like such an embarrassing dad. I like basically a cuck that I had to do this letter. It was utterly humiliating for me. So the point for me, and there's other aspects too, like I'm a musician, our job is the pursuit of truth. So if I have this letter, like whatever I put out now it's degraded by that letter. It loses impact because I'm not there's an amazing Solzhenitsyn piece called Live Not By Lies that he published in 1974, I think on the eve of his expulsion from Moscow. And I'd read that maybe five times. It kept hitting me. And it's you should read it. And there's one particular paragraph that's saying, how dare you call yourself an artist if you're not prepared to live by the truth or pursue the truth? I can't remember the exact words. And that kept hitting me. And so for me, when I published, it was about getting my dignity and my soul back. And I did. So my initial response was like my conscience is clean. So I was like, I kind of could relax then after 3 months of like inner turmoil. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a very long story short.
Were you expelled from the music industry, or did a lot of people keep ties with you after that?
A weird thing happened. There's certainly a few people in the industry that I stay friends with. And funnily enough, it's a mixed one. A lot of people will privately, including major pop stars, will privately talk to me. Say, I agree with you. I actually read that book.
Did you get mad though that they weren't speaking out in your defense? At some point, I would have been like, come on, can we have someone step up?
It's like, I know what it's like. If they could lose a lot, and I understand how big a sacrifice that is, and why should they throw it away over someone they don't necessarily know? It's true that all of these things need a critical mass. Like a lot of people have been like, what the fuck is this ridiculous story? Yeah. I had actually said something. Yeah, it would have been thrown away. It goes back to what we were saying earlier about people self-centering, because if you speak out, you know, they're scared of the tar.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was the question?
Sorry, I interrupted that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Solzhenitsyn, your parallel would be being exiled from the music industry.
Oh, well, so yeah, I speak to people in the music industry still. And funnily enough, since I've been outspoken against anti-Semitism and outspoken on Israel, actually, a lot of my friends who are Jews in the industry will speak to me saying, thank you for writing this article. Thank you for doing this interview, because they cannot speak, because there's a... this is a theory, right? I don't actually know this is true, but this my theory is that there's the industry, you might think it's controlled by the elders who are the CEOs or whatever, but actually the people who generate the money are artists aged between 15 and 25. Like, that's where the big stars are. And so if you, and again, this is just theory, but if those people are so like adamant about not working with people with the wrong opinions, they might literally not work with a manager or not work at a label if they see they don't want to be associated with another person who's on there. So associating with me, although the adults, some of the adults are very happy to still see me privately, but I suspect that it's not necessarily in their professional interests to work with me. Having said that, some of them said they would, and it's not entirely... I did a US solo tour. I put out a Christmas single. So I'm still making music, and I'm nearly finished the record. So I still make music. It's just, but it is the case that, that in the music industry, in the artist section, I'm kind of tricky one to
there's an asterisk.
But it's not, I'm certainly never going to claim I'm like completely ostracized. It's more complicated than that. It's and I can put out music, and there's artists, look at someone like Ariel Pink, who went to the Trump the Jan 6 Trump rally. He didn't go to the Capitol Hill storming, but he went to the preceding rally. And he got dropped from his record label, and he'd be a good guy for you to bring on the show. He's a fun one. And and he's still putting out music, and you could still put out music independently. And you don't need a label anymore. Look what happened to Oliver Anthony.
Right.
Blew up without really much support. Need great songs and some heart.
So before we go back to Dissident Dialogues and some of the larger cultural issues, just on your story, one thing that we talked about is the lack of courage around you. And I respect what you said, where you're kind of like, if one of these big names were to speak up on your behalf, they'd be falling on their sword, potentially risking their career, a lot of people's success and reputations around them, this sort of gravy train they're on, bringing it to a crashing halt. So I get it's a lot to sacrifice. The band, Mumford & Sons. There was, I think in 2022, Marcus Mumford said they begged you to stay. Did you feel like you had that support?
No one begged me to stay. So initially I was invited to stay. But the terms were I had to apologize and there had to be action. And it was made clear to me that I would have to go along with the lie about all these politics things. Then when I explained my situation where it was affecting me and I couldn't see a way forward, there was no pushback at all. So that's not true that happened. But maybe there's a different interpretation on the other side, but it's not for me to say. But
did that drive you crazy, them knowing you for that long?
And it's been a very difficult time. It's still... difficult. Yeah.
So to bring it back to the present day here. So then you left, and like you're saying before, you got into media with a podcast, and now you've continued to grow out into this brand, the Dissident Dialogues. What was that transformation like? How easy was it for you to get into this? Were there a lot of people who were really eager to help you?
At a certain point, I was like, it happened, at a certain point I was like, I made all this sacrifice to speak what I think. It would be kind of crazy now to like just not say what I thought. Now I will add to that. So then I got a job at The Spectator with a podcast. It actually took me a while to unself-censor myself, because I trained myself, and it wasn't just in that period, even before, the political correctness in the music industry was it such that for a few years it was like, don't, you know, don't say the wrong thing. And the music journalists always wanted to talk about politics, even though it had nothing to do with the music. So that I had to learn to just speak freely. And now I feel like now I'm free. Now I can like say,
we hope you feel free in here. Yeah.
And so I actually just had I debated Nancy Pelosi last week.
I saw that. Oxford Union.
I'm very excited about
it. It's not up yet though, right?
It's not up yet, but okay. It was like, it felt good to say,
let's go.
What was the topic?
Not saying.
Populism.
Debating populism. And for me, it was, I think the last couple of years has been building up to that.
That's so cool.
It's really worth.
What's she like? What's Nancy Pelosi like?
Well.
She's a great stock trader. I don't know if you asked for any investment tips.
Yeah, I wouldn't have won that debate.
Lockheed's going up. Yeah.
I'd say before the debate, she was very nice.
Yeah.
And perfectly pleasant.
Yes.
Did photographs and it's very, very sweet. But during the debate, she got up to interrupt me a couple of times. She was seething. She was in her seat, turning around, going, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Why are you doing this? Trying, you know, going for me whilst I was doing my, giving my speech. And then afterwards stormed off furious, utterly furious with what I'd said. So your viewers will have to see what is it that I
wait
said
for this.
That so, and I did avoid ad hominem. I just let's say I'd called her out on apparent hypocrisies in her politics.
Interesting.
She was not pleased with.
Interesting.
What was more nerve-wracking, being in that debate stage against Nancy Pelosi or performing to a sold-out arena?
You know, it's so funny going to these arenas, like you don't even really, by the time you're actually playing an arena, it's like every night for 10 years you've been doing like one size up or like 10 extra people every night, so that by the time you're doing it, it's like
that's how it works.
We did Madison Square Gardens we'd already done like Barclays Center a couple of times, which is bigger, so it's like it's MSG. But
we were looking up the Mumford and Sons from your era there, the stats, this is kind of like a backhanded compliment because we obviously listen to Babel. I still listen to Mumford and Sons song, but like it's like you guys are even more successful than we realized, you know. Like I mean, crazy. You were
the stars aligned.
But it is kind of, we were thinking like that must be an interesting pivot where now you're at the Oxford Union and very different. Do you feel more personally judged when you're performing music or when you're sharing your own ideas?
Well, as you guys know, in the idea space, we were talking before we started rolling that whatever you say, someone's going to take umbrage with what you're saying. Someone's going to be upset or offended or disagree and disagree in such a way they want you to shut up. To be honest, that's kind of the case. There's a correlation. The more successful you are, the more you attract hatred or you attract detractors. Right. If anything, it's a sign that you're doing something right.
Absolutely.
Nothing worse than saying something into the wind. And
absolutely.
You know, that's a good thing.
I think too that one of the steps that, you know, most of the Roka audience, the community, you know, we have a terrific relationship. We love, I mean, we are just so unbelievably grateful and heartened every time we leave New York, especially, and you go out in the country and you meet normal, happy people. They have very similar views of the news. They're tired being told what to think. And we've built this community that's very diverse. Now, some people like Joe Rogan follow, which is great, but mostly it's a younger audience and a very diverse following. Cory Booker, Lee Stefanik, Mark Cuban, you know, it's all over the place. But some people still who just kind of like maybe their friends followed, so they checked out Roka, and you'll see some of the hate comments we get. And so we've had some of the dissidents on like an unreleased episode with Alex Berenson. We interviewed, our first interview was with the Harvard doctor who was fired for his views on the vaccine.
Martin Kulldorff.
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
We spent a lot of time with him. Such a mild mannered guy. It's so funny to see like
they're so genteel. These people.
So genteel. So to see the monster created and then you meet him.
This is something I've been thinking about. And this is actually, I think this is something I might have talked about with Barry on her podcast. But what these people, like you mentioned Martin Kulldorff, or someone like Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who did the Great Barrington Declaration with Martin, Dr. Kulldorff, I should say, I've never met
Marty, met.
Marty!
and Barry, and they're very, well, these people are very genteel and soft, and you, they're not, but now, there are some people who are antagonistic, narcissistic bullies, and they just want attention, and they and you see that. I'm not going to name names because I don't think it's a bit rude, but I would say that there's a big bulk of people who are not that and quite soft and not, you know, I'm high trait agreeableness. I'm not a disagreeable person. So it's kind of, and there's people like that. And you think, what is it that brings all these people? Like, how is it that this weird group of people emerged from the last 4 years as kind of outliers or ostracized from their universities or industries or whatever it is? And I don't know what it is exactly, but and maybe this ties into the beginning of our conversation, but something to do with they all have a strong sense of the metaphysical self. I had this conversation with Jay Bhattacharya as well, I think, on my podcast, but what it's, you know, we look at like the people in Gaza Plaza or the Antifa or the BLM lot, and they have their identities. Is it because we've taken away, because God is gone? And this is a question, I don't know the answer. I'm thinking out loud. If God is gone, and so then all we have is our identities, but our identities have to be something sort of physical or material. And then if anyone challenges them, we have to defend them with our life. Whereas if your identity is something metaphysical, your sense of soul, you're in relationship, I'm a Christian, so it's for me that's where it is. It's like I can sort of shield some of those terms that we talk about. But the most important thing is soul and truth. Then I think that's kind of what's going on. You know, Barry's practicing Jew and Dr. Bhattacharya is Christian, and I think that makes a difference.
I'm excited for the Ion Richard Dawkins debate, because I even think Dawkins, and if you don't know, he's one of the new atheists, and not just one of the, he is the face of intellectual sort of atheism, which some people would say is redundant, but we wouldn't. I'm religious as well. And he's even argued that there was sort of a benefit of cultural Christianity. Now, in terms of a point Max Frost made earlier, I think you're 100%. I mean, there's data that show that young people have replaced traditional pillars of meaning, like faith, with politics. For example, when people are looking for a dating partner, politics are more important than religion. That used to not even be close to the case, where people, a significant chunk, won't date anyone of the opposite political persuasion. It used to be true of religion. Another is more society writ large. The pillars of community have sort of disintegrated. Family has deteriorated. The number of meals you eat with the family per week. All these sort of metrics you can have about the traditional pillars of meaning. Friends, young people see friends less than they used to. This is the work of Jonathan Haidt, Greg Lukianoff is going to be there. Yeah. Others. So long story short is, objectively, people have replaced the traditional sources of meaning with politics. And Arthur Brooks, a social scientist at Harvard, talks about, you know, people with bumper stickers are less likely to be happy. Like, that's a finding. Yeah, so it's really interesting. And I think you see this with peers, really? Right? Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, people have to have something, right, that drives them, that gives them meaning. And it's like, especially a lot of people, you know, we're sitting here in Manhattan, how many people work in some high-rise building where they're one of 200,000 employees, and they want something to drive them forward? And, you know, for better or for worse, especially, I think a lot of generations try to do the opposite of the older generation, right? They want to get rid of religion. They want to get rid of, you know, the patriarchy, all these different kind of things. But yeah, something has to replace it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. A lot of these new atheists who are so influential against the, you know, against the woke movement or kind of whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously this is a criticism, right? Is you can do that. And then what follows it, well, exactly what you're fighting against.
At Dissident Dialogues, Alex O'Connor is going to be having this debate with John Vivekee, the meaning crisis, where I think they both probably will find common ground in accepting that there is, the all of these post almost pagan faiths like wokeism or environmentalism are a result of the removal of God, but they won't probably. I think Vivekee is a theist and O'Connor is an atheist. So how do we create meaning in a world when not everyone, you, when you can't prove God, and not everyone is necessarily a believer. And that's also Dawkins versus Ayan. Ayan went from being in the Muslim Brotherhood to a famous, she wasn't in the four horses of the apocalypse, yeah, or horsemen of the apocalypse, but she was certainly a very prominent new atheist along with Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so she's going to be having that debate with Dawkins, and she's now a Christian. I think that question is very important. A friend of mine, Peter Boghossian, you've had him on your show. He said something recently earlier, because he's also another new atheist, and he's written about it and prominent in that world. He said to me privately, it's like maybe better to believe someone walked on water 2,000 years ago than all this nonsense that we're seeing now. Like maybe, you know, we all make a leap of faith at some point, but maybe some leaps of faith are healthier than others.
Well, you know what's so weird is there's this strange alliance that has taken place between new atheists and practicing religious people. And then outside of that alliance are more the two polar ends of the spectrum, where sort of the woke left and what some people are now calling the woke right, obviously they don't share the ideological tenets of the woke left, but their tactics are very similar. Canceling. I think there's sort of a Salem witch trial that goes into anyone who's ever pictured with Bill Gates or ever took a dollar from a certain group, even if it was one droplet in their pool of funding. You know, there are anyone who supports Israel is a Zionist sellout. Yeah. Even if you disagree with the Israeli funding, you know, there's this sort of weird effect. So, but like where Pinker is now agreeing, who's upholding, in other words, classical liberalism today? It feels like there are two forces. The atheists like Pinker, who believe reason is transcendent, and then sort of natural law proponents who believe in civility discourse and are more moderate. I there's just a strange alliance.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe, like Ben Shapiro with those people. He's religious and they see the world very similarly. Dave Rubin. Yeah.
What's exciting to me though is that the atheist bunch, even Dawkins now, I think he's always probably said he's a cultural Christian, but recognizes that some of the nonsense that we've seen in the last few years is a result of the success of the new atheist movement.
Mm.
That they really killed God.
Mm.
And convincingly so. And so then what happened? Oh, well, there's a lot of people who have completely meaningless lives.
Yeah.
And they have to have meaning. It's not like you can live without meaning.
Right.
You can't, you can.
Okay. We've tried. We don't have any of those pillars. I'm single. I've got nothing. Yeah.
Oh, if this is a meaningless life, it's going very well. Good for you guys.
Well, I'm curious. Before, you know, I think we're talking about the term radical, right? Radical right. Mm. The Ben Shapiro example is interesting because have you followed this whole thing with Candace Owens?
Loosely, I not enough that I could comment on it.
Well, what I'm curious is kind of like where you draw the, because so much of this, it's so hard to draw a line, right? Between, for example, whatever. I guess I put it to you this way, with the Distant Dialogues, right? You're trying to bring in as many diverse perspectives as possible.
Yeah.
Is there any line that you would draw anywhere, and what's the line?
That is a good question. Yeah, there are actually lines. There's some topics I just don't see the point in. I think race IQ, I don't understand what's to be gained from that thing. And it's for me, it's a very icky conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that means that I'm a pussy and not really a dissident after all.
But I was about to call you that.
Yeah, I don't, that's not a topic. I don't want eugenics at my, anything to do with. I think I don't want particularly. I think, you know, I do believe in free speech, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't be allowed to talk about that. But I don't think that that's something. I also believe in constructive conversations,
right.
And I think that conversations should have. There should be something positive. There should be something meaningful that we can all agree why it's meaningful to have the conversation in the first place. So. That's an easy question. What about you? What? Who would you not have on the show?
Mm.
We asked our audience in our app. We do polls. We can put polls within stories. So we asked our audience, if Hitler wanted to come on our podcast, would you want Hitler? Would you want us to interview Hitler?
Uh-huh.
And 80% said yes.
Yeah.
Would I sit here with Hitler? I certainly don't think I would. However, I don't. I mean, there's a natural. people, I mean, shouldn't, it would depend on who Hitler was, right, at the time. And it would depend on who anyone is at the time. I do think the tendency of sweeping ideas under the rug.
Hitler, yeah.
Yeah. Pre-World War, no. No.
1944.
I mean, the more an idea is silenced, the more traction it gains. I mean, they threw him in jail and he penned Mein Kampf and he came out and gave it to the world.
I think a lot matters, like context. For example, an event would we, you know, I think that's, I hate the verb platform. We hate it so much because it implies endorsement and it rarely is, where you're kind of like, you're platforming this speaker, this view. And it, I mean, people have said, because it's so early in the show, they're like, oh, you've had a bunch of these anti-vax people on. By the way, we're always going to skew people who aren't represented by the mainstream media because that's a big part of the niche we fill. So even though we'll try to get both sides of an issue, we're always going to skew people who are acting in good faith, who are smart. And good faith is a key.
Yeah, good faith is
a qualifier. But like, for example, you know, like Tucker and Putin, I think the context matters. So would Putin belong at a conference? I don't know. But like for an interview for a news company, yeah, I think so. But then there's another thing, is how do you conduct the interview? I mean, if you're doing softball interview, softball questions, that's kind of...
I mean, if it were 1939 and, you know, Hitler wanted to tell the American people his beliefs, shouldn't the American people have been aware of what he thought? I mean, I know that's not a perfect example, but...
Yeah. No, that is a good example. And I think it's very good to interview Putin, even at a conference, because it's people... To not interview him assumes that the audience is stupid and can't work out for themselves whether something's evil or not.
I'm pro Putin at a conference now. That's a good point.
I think it's great that Tucker interviewed Putin. And by the way, it's not easy to interview someone because you don't know where they're going to go with it. And so, from his point of view, Putin took an angle that was like, "What the bloody hell?" Like, if I was interviewing Putin at that point, I'd be like, "Okay, wait, what? Like, how do we?"
I'm glad when we ask you, tell your story about, you know, that 21 tweet that you were in, like, so. The Magna Carta in 1215. You just start in the 13th century, just like, how do you interrupt that? Plus, he's in Russian.
It's tricky. Yeah.
Good faith is key, though.
Yeah, good faith is key. There's one guy I would have. I mean, look, when I posted a photograph with Pelosi after our debate, and I lost a lot of followers.
Really?
And for me, it's like, and because people hate her in this country, I didn't realize how much they hate her.
They hate her.
I'd say she's part of like the four horsemen of hated politicians in America.
Right. But I'm not scared to have a photograph with her. But I would definitely have her on my podcast. There are some characters I wouldn't have Nick Fuentes anywhere near.
Yeah.
I fucking hate him. Like, I'm angry. Yeah. Another person I don't necessarily know that much, but I just don't find interesting, is Andrew Tate. I don't think he's got anything interesting to say, and I don't think he's adding anything of value. So why wouldn't I give? But again,
I'm with you. But I think with the latter, I think he's a creation. What a lot of people miss is, I'm with you, but I think he's a creation of this vilification of masculinity and this sort of void that it's left, where people feel this tug from what their coastal liberal teachers are telling them and how bad their masculinity is and the patriarchy, let's dismantle, yada, yada.
Yeah, yeah.
And then their natural biological instincts and depictions and culture, and they're kind of like, but I totally agree.
And then they kicked him off social media and his celebrity skyrocketed.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew Tate's what you get when you vilify Jordan Peterson for like years and years and years, try and get rid of him, say he's la 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 ha for ages. And then what happens? Okay, then you make him bad. And then where do you think the kids are going to go? Yeah. They go really to like the extremes. And that's kind of what I think is Tate's done.
So
maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's just a surface.
Totally. I mean, and I think the New York Times and the Atlantic and places like that have nobody to blame but themselves. Like, you think of the books they write fawning profiles over. There's just one called White Rural Rage. Maybe you agree with the thesis that white people are the biggest threat to democracy because they're more racist, misogynist, homophobic.
Agree with that thesis.
Well, it's, I'm saying a generic thesis. That's a racist thesis. Yeah, but like that book on MSNBC and New York Times got praise. And now people will hear us say that and they'll be like, go after Fox News, which we do all the time. Fox News throws red meat to an audience, boosts anger, and creates sub-rational narratives about crime, migrants, and other groups that I think are false, even if you agree with some of the, like, all sorts of problems. But the problem is, New York Times is such authority. So when New York Times and The Atlantic wrote pieces on Jordan Peterson early, he was put in a bubble. And ever since then, he's kind of like been forced to just spar with wokies all the time in a way that I think has probably shifted his outlook a little bit.
You know, what you got to remember about the New York Times is that in the 1930s, they shilled for Hitler. Yeah. In the 1950s, they shilled for Stalin. And in the late 50s, they shilled for Fidel Castro. So I tell you what, if the New York Times don't approve, that's a good thing. You don't want to be approved by the New York Times. You're not in good company. That's my take on that.
That's a great take.
Disgusting. Organization. And another thing, actually, let's talk more about the present. I don't know if you saw both the correspondence dinner, the Colin Joseph speech with Biden, and then also Biden on Howard Stern. Now, Jost finished his piece with this like, oh, you know, the best thing about you, Biden, is that you're so, what was the word he used?
Decent.
Yeah, decency.
Yeah.
Decency. Oh, I'm just so grateful for your decency.
Yeah.
Your decency. Oh, I don't care that the world's burning. I don't care that there's war in Ukraine and Russia and Gaza and Israel and Afghanistan and Taiwan on the brink, because decency. And by the way, Biden's not decent. All that Colin Jost meant by that was that Trump isn't decent in Joseph's opinion. He doesn't think that Biden's decent. No one thinks that Biden's decent. What they think is Trump is deplorable.
And then Howard Stern.
And Howard Stern. Oh,
the father of the country.
Ugh, the most ingratiating.
And then Drew Barrymore with Kamala Harris saying, we need you to be Mamala.
Oh, like these people, they're supposed to be journalists. What they're shills. It's a propaganda machine. It's so embarrassing. But
you know, you've been at the top. I mean, is this like pervasive or people
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the creative industries, Hollywood and music. Now, it's slightly more complicated because this comes into personality types. And this is something that we mentioned Jonathan Haidt earlier. He did this in Moral Foundations Theory, but you can also look at Jordan Peterson's got it in his personality, Big Five Personality Types. There is a correlation between personality types and political leanings.
Yes.
And so all industries will group people by personality types. Creative industries, it's high trait openness and high agreeableness generally and some other traits. But those correlate, as Jonathan Haidt showed, with what Haidt called the poet. So if you have an industry which is dominated by people who are creative, that means that they're going to have a specific leaning politically. In the same, Wall Street is going to be dominated by high trait conscientiousness and people who are probably, it's probably completely free market, neoliberal, because, and then on top of that, you have groupthink for community groupthink. So you have all these things compounding each other. The thing that's slightly weirder with the creative industries is that you would think they'd be high in trait or high in openness to ideas, which is slightly different to openness or high compassion. It is not slightly different. It's completely different. And you would think that they would be like that. And I think that there are some groups, but unfortunately those people are self-censoring within the industry. But so I say all this to say, if it wasn't already not already implicit, which is that we see Hollywood, or today I see a tweet by Obama with Jason Bateman and on his podcast with Clinton and Biden doing like why you have to vote for Biden again, and basically shilling for the establishment left, which is cringe to me from a rock and roll point of view. It's like, I thought that rock and roll and Hollywood are supposed to be anti-establishment. No, they are the establishment. But they don't even see it because their political leaning is that way naturally anyway because of their character dispositions. And then I also just don't think, I think that the bubble that they're all in, they're not exposed necessarily to all those ideas. I don't know. I'm theorizing and maybe I'm pontificating. I don't know like what's actually, but that's my impression.
Stephen Colbert, I mean, you look at the late night hosts and it feels like they're DNC operatives at this point, you know, where it's like, well, we are running out of time.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, my goodness. This was a joy.
Congratulations on all the success.
Well, we hope we're grateful to the Roku community. We got to keep going. We're just starting off this show.
Yeah.
And
they'll be eager to hear your story. I mean, a lot of them already know it, but to hear from you directly.
Are you going to come to Distant Dialogues?
We would love to.
That'd be terrific.
We'd be honored to.
Awesome. Well, let's hang then.
That'd be great. My brother literally texted me this week and asked me if I want to buy a ticket.
Well,
so
doesn't need to buy one.
Well, no.
Stop. Please invite your brother.
He'll stay home.
No, seriously. What do you mean, though?
I'll bring him. But this has been amazing to talk to you, and we will be there. And to anyone who watches and listens,
check it
out. We encourage you to check it out as well.
DissidentDialogues.org. tickets still going. Get day tickets. We've mentioned already. I'm going to do this.
Do it.
So we've mentioned Dawkins and Ian. We've got Lee Fong and Michael Schellenberger is doing a keynote. Yep. Aisha Akami, John McWhirter.